This is the Ed Milet Show.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm so excited to have this lady here with me. I'm fascinated by her work. And because the applications in so many different areas of my own life, and I believe for the audience today, she's got a new book out called Peak Mind. She's a neuroscientist, professor of psychology at University of Miami, and I already like her. Amishi Jha, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So good. So I have so many things I want to ask you, and I'm going to cram it into 1 hour. So first things first, there's this fallacy, evidently, that we use only a percentage of our brain. There's, you know, you're 10% of your brain, 32% of your brain. People love to throw these statistics around. Yeah. But as I'm prepping and learning about your work, you say not true at all.
Oh, not true at all.
Okay, tell me.
No way. I mean, the brain takes up so much of our metabolic energy. Nothing is wasted. Mm. And the way to think about the brain is as a unit. Usually we think about bits and pieces and communication between those bits and pieces, but it's really the configuration of the whole thing, just like a team. Mm. So you'd never say that, you know, if you have all the players on the team, some may be more active than others, but you don't say the whole team's not playing the game. Mm. Same idea with the brain. It's entirely used.
Okay.
And some parts may be actively suppressed and other parts may be actually really activated.
Do highly performing people have some functionality in their brain or a presence about them that people that don't function at that same level have? Like, what separates them?
Oh,
did
yeah.
You say peak mind, what does that mean?
To me, a peak mind has to do with the area that I actually specialize in, attention.
Okay.
So a peak mind is a mind that has full access to its attentional resources. Hmm. Nothing is lost or hidden. And by the way, that doesn't always mean you're focused.
Okay.
It means that you know exactly in a moment-to-moment context where your attention is, even if it's off-leash doing whatever the heck it wants to do.
Okay, so attention means I'm aware I'm no longer focused on the task at hand, the initial task, and that's still being in full attention. Is that what you're saying? I'm trying to understand that.
Yeah. So attention is this complex, multifaceted system, and it really developed over the course of evolution because we've got a very big problem. The brain had a very big problem,
Okay. Which
is that, and we can see it if we just look around right now, there's so much information available to it,
yeah.
It cannot possibly process all of it.
Okay.
So attention provides a solution to prioritize a subset of the information and then hone in on it to get fuller access. So we actually make sense of the world by sampling different pieces of it to kind of put together the entirety.
Okay. So, here we go. This is already getting good. So I went right into the content without even positioning things because I'm so fascinated. But as you can now tell everybody, we're going to talk today about mindfulness an awful lot. And we're going to talk today about getting better at getting your attention focused. I use the word focus, use a different word. But so I'm watching one of your TED Talks. And by the way, I want to encourage everybody to go watch them. The one I watched is awesome. At one point in the talk, you say, well, I basically got 8 minutes left. You will listen to about 50% of what I'm about to say.
Yep.
And I thought to myself, wow, the application of missing 50% of something, maybe in listening to a talk, okay, whatever. But what's that mean for an athlete who's in a 5-round UFC fight? What's it mean for a surgeon who's going to operate on someone's body? What's it operate for a soldier or a law enforcement person to lose attention for that percentage of time? So that's actually accurate that the average person is, their attention is there 50% of the time?
Yeah. I mean, that's study after study after study.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, and some of these studies are really interesting the way that they're done, and they're done in a very rudimentary way. We've gotten more and more sophisticated, but the initial studies, all that happened was you said, okay, you know, Ed, will you sign up for my study? Yes. I'm going to text you any time of day during waking hours. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. And the questions would be something like, what are you doing right now? And you'd get a little list of options, like reading a book, talking to a person, whatever those options are, you click. And then the second question is, where is your attention right now? Is it on the task you're doing or somewhere else?
Hmm.
And that kind of experience sampling suggested 50%.
Gosh.
But then we brought it into the lab and we had people do tasks that are attentionally demanding. And even then, even though they know they're there to do a task, 50%.
Mm.
You pay people to say, don't get distracted, still, very high percentage of time.
They still get distracted.
It's just the nature of the mind. And I think knowing that can be very empowering in some sense.
Is there such a thing as multitasking or is that a fallacy? In other words, can the brain do more than one thing at one time?
Great question. I'm so glad you asked that. So if more than one thing is intentionally demanding, you cannot do more than one thing at one time.
Okay.
The term multitasking is actually a myth.
Okay.
The correct term would be task switching.
Task switching.
Yes. So what you're doing, and this is actually, frankly, one of the most exhausting things you can do to your brain, okay, is engage your attention and then have to disengage it, move it to the next thing, come back, and move it over and over again.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And when we ask, when we tell people this, you know, it's, people always get, it's like, yeah, it takes me a while to get back into the thing I was doing. So don't do that to yourselves. This is my main, like, guidance for people.
Okay.
Don't have your alerts on when you're trying to actually do deep work and focus, because you're disadvantaging your ability to actually do the task that you're trying to do. I mean, if already the baseline is 50%, and now you got to deal with things pulling you away, the chances of it actually being successful are even reduced more.
So what's the solution then? In other words, you talk a great deal about mindfulness. Why don't we position that? I'm pretty familiar, I would say, that I've practiced mindfulness for a while, but not on the level and to the extent, nor with some of the exercises that you recommend. So is the solution in your, is a generic answer mindfulness for you? And then why don't you elaborate on what that actually means?
Sure. I mean, I think that, first of all, I'll just tell you my personal bias, right? So coming into this, I mean, you could see me, I'm an Indian woman.
Mm-hmm.
The term meditation or mindfulness meditation, I mean, these were not things that I was unfamiliar with growing up.
Sure.
But I kind of didn't want anything to do with it. I was a true skeptic. In fact, I thought it was not a serious enterprise and had other reasons for not wanting to go in the direction of practicing meditation at all,
okay,
because of some sexist aspects of the culture, et cetera. I was like, no, not for me. So my topic, my expertise is in the brain science of attention. That's what I studied. And it was just a total life circumstances that even opened me up to the possibility of mindfulness entering my lab's work. So I just want to frame that.
It's interesting.
You know, it's very hard for people to know, especially when I walk into military bases. They usually think I'm the mindfulness lady, and then the neuroscientist is the other person that's with me. And I'm like, nope, flip that.
Well, what's interesting, not to interrupt you, but that's what I thought originally. So when the opportunity to speak with you was presented to me, I went, okay, I've had some meditation people on before. I'm actually more interested in the science part of it.
Right.
Then I look into you and I'm like, oh, hold on a second here.
Right.
This is a person who comes from the scientific perspective. She's a neuroscientist. Now we're talking about mindfulness.
Yeah,
so that's
exactly
really interesting.
So, you know, it's not something, and it was probably 2 or 3 years into me having my own lab that it entered my lab's landscape. And it really came because I was at a crossroads in my personal life. I was, you know, a young child at that point. I was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and everything was sort of on paper and to the external world exactly as I'd wanted it, right? I got this dream job. I have a beautiful family, and we just bought a 100-year-old fixer-upper in West Philly, and we're renovating it, and like everything was great and like the way that I had planned for it to be. But I had a real wake-up call. There were two things that happened that really were like, something's up. First, I lost feeling in my teeth from grinding. That was odd. And then one night I was reading to my son and had no idea what I was reading in the book. Like he asked me, he was like maybe not even 3 years old. He stopped, put his little hand on the book and like looks up like, what do we, you know, what does this word mean? And I'm like, I have no idea what I'm reading. And it was this kind of deep feeling of, my goodness, I am not here at all. I am not paying attention to my life. And if this is happening now and he's this tiny, like how is it gonna flow as he gets older? And things, as you know, as you've got teenagers, things get more complicated.
Yeah.
So anyway, just to say that, I became like I was on a hunt. I study attention. I'm an expert in this. Okay, let me just read something about how to fix this thing. Like I'm distracted. How do I fix it? Nothing in my field would guide me to what to do. And so we tried a lot of different things, even in the lab, because it sort of paralleled what the lab was studying at that time of we knew attention can be vulnerable to things like stress and threat, et cetera, but we didn't have any solutions there.
Yeah.
So anyway, so it ended up, just to give you a sense of why mindfulness entered
the lab. Yeah.
I was at a seminar, actually. This was about early 2000, so mindfulness was not a term. Like, I would have never thought at that point, 2021, I'd be talking to somebody that would say, oh yeah, I practice mindfulness.
Yeah.
Like, definitely not something I thought would happen. But this colleague of mine, a very eminent neuroscientist who studies something called affective neuroscience, the neuroscience of emotion, and he presented, he was like at the front of this large lecture hall, and he presented like two brain images on the screen. A very positive looking brain, meaning he had induced people while they're in the scanner to feel in a positive mood.
Okay.
And then a negative brain. And I'm like, at the end of the lecture, I raised my hand. I was like, okay, how do you get that brain to look like that brain? Okay. You know, like kind of just in a, and he was very flippant about it. He was just like, meditation. And I was like, what? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't think so. Ended up, I talked to him later and he was in a serious initial stages of studies that now we've all probably heard of with adept monastics, monks.
Yep.
And so it was very intriguing to me. And I was kind of like, oh, but I don't want anything to do with this. This is not serious. And I had my own personal baggage. And I ended up walking into the Penn bookstore and pulled a book off called Meditation for Beginners. And I just said, let me just check it out. It ended up that that book was by one somebody who's quite dear to me now as a teacher, Jack Kornfield. And Jack...
the book. I know the book.
Yeah. And Jack has a little... It's a little tiny book and has a guided CD. I'm like, okay, look. I'm a skeptic, but I'm just going to try it. I'm just going to try it. And it's like 10, 15, 20 minute practices. So I committed to it. And what I realized as it was happening, as I was going through this day after day, and probably about a month or so in, I'm like, oh, this thing is entirely, the instructions are plainly about attention. And this thing is transforming the way that I pay attention. Mm. I felt more embodied. I felt more aware. I could notice the little grimaces on my son's face or maybe a concerned look in my spouse's eyes. Like just everything became crystal clear and more alive to me. And none of the stresses had changed. I mean, the pressures of my life were the same, but I felt more capable, really more at my peak.
How quickly?
About 4 to 6 weeks.
That's what it was for me too, which are really amazing that you're saying this is that I had a somewhat similar experience where I, you know, sort of the financial well-being of my life had turned around. I'm living on the ocean. You know, I've got all these things in my life that I wanted. And I just struggled with finding some peace. Mm. I struggled with being present, clarity of thought. And actually what I felt like too for me was like, I had stopped growing emotionally, psychologically, and mentally. Like I was still producing more external results, but there was just a part of me that wasn't expanding. Mm. And maybe I was even regressing. I grabbed the exact same book.
Really?
Yeah, that's what's ironic about it. When you said that, I wanted to make sure it was the same author before I jumped in.
Oh my goodness.
I know, it's amazing. I grabbed the exact same book. But as we're talking, I realized even recently, maybe I've not stayed as dedicated to some of those practices as I could. So being with you has sort of inspired me to do it.
A lot of times, you know, just I'm anticipating, people may be like, okay, I've heard of mindfulness, I'll even do it. But I want to deepen the understanding.
Please.
And maybe even, it might even actually motivate you to kind of try a little bit more regularly.
Yeah.
Of what attention is and why it ended up being such an interesting solution for us to bring it into the lab. Because after this happened, to kind of get back to the to where I was in my journey, after this happened, I was like, okay, this is pretty interesting, but I'm one person. This is an anecdotal self-study.
Yeah.
So if this is for real, then let's put it to the test in the most rigorous way possible.
Okay.
And hey, I happen to have all the tools of studying attention. I can actually bring this to the lab and we can do this seriously. So that summer, like a few months after I started this whole journey, I wrote my first grant to investigate this and put really literally like, if this has any chance of actually being real, it will have to really be there or in order for us to see it, or else it'll just not show up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with this kind of randomized controlled trials and ensuring that we're very clear about the protocols, et cetera. So, anyway, so I just wanted to mention that this entered the lab because I was curious, but I was very open to the fact that it could be anecdotal.
It could be just you.
It could be just me.
Yep.
Because I would love to share a practice with you, and you'll find it very familiar since you've been practicing mindfulness. But the reason that I was willing to write the grant, and I think the reason I've been able to get grant after grant is because it truly taps into these aspects of attention that the brain science says exist. But currently, at least at the moment that I started this work, there was really no insight into how to train each of these brain systems.
Mm.
So it's like, we know they exist, we know they're vulnerable. The piece that I wanted to actually explore is it trainable?
Yes.
So, because that's when, as you know, I mean, that's where the expansion, the growth can happen.
Right.
So anyway, so let's just, I mean, I love the question that you asked me regarding attention, and you said the term focus.
Yeah.
But that actually is just one part of the attention landscape.
So, this is important to know before an exercise so we know what we're actually working on. So yeah.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. I think that it helped me understand why it would be worth doing this, what seemingly is a very weird thing to do with sit quietly and pay attention to your breath, which we'll break it down, but still that's essentially what it's gonna come to. Okay, so just one of the things I like to do because it helps me explain and understand even how these systems work. I mean, we already talked broadly that attention is solving a problem for the brain. It doesn't exist for no reason. It exists to emphasize certain aspects of our experience. And the metaphor I like to use that really is tied to the term you said, focus, is of a flashlight, right? So that's the metaphor. If you're in a darkened path, you know, you have this beautiful ocean view here, you want to go for a little walk in the evening, you might take a flashlight with you.
Okay.
Why? Because wherever it is that flashlight is pointing, you're going to get privileged access to
information. Yeah. Okay.
So same thing with attention. When we attend to something, like right now, if I'm looking at your face, I'm getting granular information regarding your face. And everything else is sort of becoming a fuzzy in the same way that wherever we point that flashlight, everything else is darkened around it.
Mm-hmm.
Same idea. And that's a very active process that the brain is doing. The brain is enhancing the neural activity of the part of space I'm focusing on and actively suppressing everything else around it.
Yeah, that's good.
So that part is I think most people can understand the term focus is a very common thing.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing about this flashlight, though, is it's not only about the external environment, but it's about the internal environment as well. So if I say, think about what you had for dinner last night. Can you do that?
I can.
You can do that, right?
Yes.
So what happened in that moment? Before I said that, probably it was not on your mind.
Oh, so good.
Right?
So good.
So you had it come to mind in your memory, and then basically you were shining the flashlight on the memory.
Wow.
And all of a sudden it's in your conscious experience. So think about the power of this focusing capacity. I mean, I do refer to it as a type of fuel because we need it to have a train of thought. We need it to experience emotion and regulate emotion. And we certainly need it to connect with other people. But still, that's only part of the puzzle. But I hope that at least the flashlight thing makes sense.
That isn't, I'll never forget that.
Well,
I'll never forget that as long as I continue to practice mindfulness. If I don't, potentially I will forget that. Okay, so I won't forget that. What an unbelievable analogy, because you made me pull a visual, a file up almost in my brain that was suppressed. It was the one that went to the background.
Yeah,
and once we shine the light on it, this is so good. Okay, so now that we're at this space, obviously you now have proven scientifically that this is trainable, expandable, almost like a muscle and a bicep, that if it's trained regularly, it can become stronger and grow.
Yeah.
So if I'm into, I know when most of my audience knows, if I want to go to a gym and I want to build my bicep, they kind of have a general idea. Here's an array of exercises you can do to build that.
Correct.
What is one of them that we can do to build this?
You're going to be mad because I'm going to say, wait, hold on, but there's more. I feel like I'm trying to send you Ginsu knives or something. But because it's really like the body, and you know that if you only work certain muscle groups, there's others that will atrophy.
Yes.
And there is a cross-training aspect to this.
Wow.
So I want to make sure we cover the other aspects.
Let's do it. Well, that's part of the training.
Of attention, right?
Okay.
So the focusing is one piece of the puzzle.
Okay.
But attention is this multifaceted component. And there's two other systems that I think are really worth mentioning. The other system is something I call the floodlight. And it really is formally called the alerting system of the brain. It's almost, you could say, the exact opposite of the flashlight. Whereas the flashlight is narrow and selective, the floodlight is broad and receptive.
Okay.
There is nothing you should be privileging. The only thing you're privileging is what is happening right now. So you're privileging time, like right now, in this moment, what is the most important thing? And you know, we use this system all the time. You're driving down the road, you see a flashing yellow light near a construction zone or a weird traffic pattern. You know what that feeling is of, like, broad and receptive. I don't know what weirdness is gonna happen, but I'm here for it because I might need to take action like that, and then I'll be able to direct the flashlight where it's needed. But I have to have that preparatory kind of broad receptivity.
Okay.
So
flashlight, floodlight.
Flashlight, floodlight, right. Both really important. Then the third system is actually, and this will sound familiar too once I start talking about it, it's actually something called executive control.
Okay.
And we use that term executive because it really is like the executive of a company. The job of this executive system is as a manager to ensure that the goals we have and the behavior we engage in align. So the analogy I use there is a juggler. So essentially, all the balls need to be in the air. As a leader in an organization, you know that you're not going to go in and do every task, but you need to make sure there's a rhythmicity, there's an appropriateness to all the things that are being done. And this juggler basically guides the action of these other systems, of the flashlight and the floodlight. So now I think with those three in mind, we can talk about the cross-training aspect of one of the practices.
Very, very good.
Helpful?
Yeah, I appreciate that background because I'm thinking about the... for me, when I listen to things, and I know people think differently, I'm constantly thinking of the application.
Yeah.
So when I hear the science or the exercise, I know you, that's why your work's so wonderful. I'm thinking of the application.
Right.
I'm thinking of people, like for example, when you talked about the floodlight, I'm thinking of people who overuse their flashlight. And those sometimes are people who are good at certain tasks or certain behaviors, but they have an inability to see the room.
You got it.
They have an inability to see the context of things sometimes.
Yeah.
And so this floodlight aspect, I'm thinking, what part of those am I pretty good at? I don't know so much about the juggler part. I think that's probably the part maybe that I struggle with, but I am pretty good, I think, of coming in and being able to have that floodlight and seeing the bigger perspective and then narrowing my focus down to what matters. And so the application as you're listening to this is really, really fascinating stuff, because you could be unbelievable at focusing in certain aspects of what you do in your life, but you're missing the bigger story, the bigger context, the bigger vision. Then there's other people, I think, who can see the big thing, but maybe they're weaker at being able to narrow their focus for the period of time they need to engage with somebody or to be present with them or to persuade them or to knock a putt in the hole or whatever that it might be. So that is fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's a really great, like, connecting the dots. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to keep in mind is we need all three systems, and they need to be functioning
together
fluidly.
Yes.
Like, they don't function at the same time.
Right.
In fact, technically in the brain, they battle each other for prominence. So you can't be in both a floodlight and a flashlight mode. And we know this, right? So you're immersed in reading something or listening to something. Somebody walks in the room and says your name. You're like, it takes you a second because the floodlight is essentially being dampened down. Mm-hmm. The receptivity to the environment is dampened down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that
can I give you an example of that?
Please.
Because I think the transition between those, I'll call them states.
Yes.
The transition between those states is something that I think people that perform at a high level have an ability to transition better. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. An NFL quarterback walks up to the line of scrimmage. What they're doing is they're in the floodlight state at that point, because the floodlight state is, I've got to read the field. I've got to read the defense, right? This is almost like walking into a board meeting, but in a quarterback sense, when I'm working with them, they're walking in, they're surveying the entire field. What's the defense? Where's the linebacker? Is this person blitzing? They're looking at the floodlight. It's their ability to then deduce and make assessments about the floodlight state they're in. And then as the ball snapped, move into the flashlight and hone in on the open wide receiver. That's the application for a quarterback, right?
Yeah.
And so, and then it's the juggling part is pretty obvious of what they have to do during that play. So you should be listening to this or watching this thing about the application in your life as a father, as a mother, as a business person, as an athlete. So I just want to make sure that we're sort of going to application, just giving one example as we do.
It's so cool, the resonance between even the terminology we used when we trained the University of Miami football team, scan the field. Eye on the ball. And you know, these are very similar terms to what we were saying, and the reason that they should be practicing these particular practices. So absolutely, these are things that are relevant. I love what you said regarding assess the situation. And I want to just say one more thing regarding that.
Yeah.
That happens often when we assess, right? When I say observe or be receptive to what's happening, there's an aspect of that that has to be free of a particular perspective of what you think you're seeing.
Okay.
So if you come in and you think, oh, I know what this team is going to do, then you're going to read that field very, the playing field very differently than if you're like, I don't really know what they're going to do. I got to really be able to get all the data of what's going on because I'm not sure. I'll probably figure it out as stuff starts happening of what the other team is attempting to do. But that is a very important aspect because we default into that sort of story making or conceptual elaboration.
Can I ask you about that? Because now you're really going down a road I love and I'm fascinated by. We have these predisposed belief systems like you just described. We believe when we walk in a room, there's a certain environment or certain treatment, a certain scenario, or our inability to see something also, right? Does our brain somehow then help reveal to us what it is that we believe most clearly in that environment with that floodlight or that flashlight?
The reality I think we have to consider is that in many circumstances, in many high stress, high stakes consequences, we have no idea what the conceptual overlay should be. And it can be quite problematic to assume you do.
Okay.
And can I give you an example?
I want it. Yes.
Yeah. So this is an example actually from a colleague, a dear now friend who happened to be then he was a colonel, he's now a 3-star general. And he gave me this example. This is, again, in the initial stages of talking about mindfulness and why it matters. He got it immediately of why, and I'll connect the dots back to the practice that you asked about. So he's describing this scenario in Afghanistan, actually probably now 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, no, not 20 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, okay. Right at the beginning of the whole episode there. And they got intelligence that on this mountaintop is a Taliban encampment. Mm-hmm. And their job was to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Basically, there were planes flying above, and he was told, you give us the word, and we're going to drop a bomb, get rid of these bad guys, right? So he wanted to, as the leader, and ensure that this is the right thing to do. That was totally the story. All the intelligence had told them that. So they're going up the mountain to actually confront this group of people that they heard were there. Mm-hmm. And ahead of him were a couple of scouts. So he's like behind, they're going up front, and the scout says, you know, yeah, look, we see young men in this age range. They're standing outside the quarters of where they're staying, and all looks good. You know, yes, it's exactly what we think it is. And then the leader was about to say, yeah, drop, go ahead, yep, and drop. Then the next sentence comes in that changed everything.
Okay.
The soldier said, I see no weapons. And that was like a, that's not typical. Mm-hmm. And then he said, I see no weapons. I'm just going to go tackle the guy. Like,
yeah.
And so he runs in, tackles the guy. And then a few seconds later, these angry women come out of the tents. Like, what are you doing to our family members?
Oh my gosh.
It was not a Taliban encampment. Thank it was God. A Bedouin tribe that had been coming there for hundreds of years.
Thank God.
Thank God.
Yeah, thank God.
And so the insight for this military leader was, he had intrinsic mindfulness. He was able to drop the story and see what is.
Yes.
He saw what wasn't there, which most of us don't do.
Yes.
So this is what I think, in addition to these attentional aspects, this, yep, is what we can get into with mindfulness, because mindfulness is about paying attention to our present moment experience.
Right.
Without conceptual elaboration, without a story or editorializing it, and without having emotional reactivity to it.
Okay, so we're going right there, but I want to go back. You said true and false to what I said.
Yes.
And I like knowing where I'm false. That way I'm not false anymore. What was incorrect about what I asked you
there? It was not that there was anything incorrect.
Okay.
If you go into a situation thinking you have a story that's going to guide you, absolutely, 100% you are correct.
Yep.
That attention will be biased in, yep, favor of the story.
Yes.
But that can be not beneficial always. The only part of what I was saying was that it can have consequences. You were painting a beneficial picture, but that's not the key.
Got it, because I actually teach it in the latter, meaning I actually think most of the time it's
too hard. Then I take it back.
No. Well, what I wanted to make sure is that this idea of what we do believe strongly guides our attention in an environment.
Oh, 100%,
and that's,
yes,
the part that, yeah, I don't believe, just to be clear, I think most people aren't wired for it to be to their benefit. I actually think that most,
yeah,
people are wired. So that's what you meant by false. It can be a negative.
It can be a negative.
Maybe,
yeah,
not true or false. It's positive negative.
Right.
And the negative I completely agree with is that if I walk into an environment, I always fail. I always find a way to make a mistake. You will gravitate towards the environment, the circumstance, the person, the whatever it is. Your flashlight begins to focus towards that. If that's your,
totally,
story going in, correct?
100%. So
okay,
let me just,
good,
like, maybe I want to emphasize how right that is.
Okay.
That is the power of story and narrative. And that's why we have to be very aware of the narrative that we're telling ourselves, because it is guiding perception, it's guiding decision making, and it's guiding action. And so you totally got it right.
And
that biasing component is important.
This is sort of, I just love you, because this is sort of the basis of what I teach.
Yeah.
Is that this story guides perception. Now you can prove it with the neuroscience more than I can.
Yeah.
But so I'm so glad to hear that it wasn't true or false, that it's actually positive or negative, because to be really candid with you, I believe that you can learn all the skills of being an entrepreneur or a mother or an athlete or a father, but if you don't begin to take control of the story of your life, of what you believe about yourself, what you believe about what's possible, what you believe about an environment, that you really have lost control over your ability to produce the results that you want. And so I'm so glad
you are. You are like, we are extremely in sync. In fact, I have a whole chapter called Drop the Story.
Oh gosh.
Because
awesome.
It's not just that we should be aware of the story. We have to also have the capacity to drop it. And that's an extra level of a skill. Mm. Because sometimes having no story allows us. So let me back up.
Yeah. So great. This is so great.
Being able to understand that you have a story will at least distance you enough so you can reframe the situation.
Yeah. I love
but
your terminology.
Being able to drop the story allows you to deframe. And when you deframe, you can build up in a different way. And that, I think, is at the next level of what we're talking about. It's like truly take in the data without as much, without any kind of conceptual overlay. That is not typical. We don't do that.
That's really interesting. See, I've always thought you better replace that story.
Yep.
You're saying that's not, it's not imperative to do that. You can actually just drop the current story and allow sort of the information to dictate what the story becomes to some extent.
Give that part more, because oftentimes we'll reframe and then we're in another story. But really savor, extend the period of time where you are data gathering. And I hear this from, you know, one of the people I talk about in the book is a lawyer, and he talks about this all the time. I have to be able to get the raw data of the experience. Or judges, same thing. Or in any business context, if you're not quite sure what's happening, allow the deframing to occur. That will give you better insight into the reframing that then occurs.
Do you think someone, gosh, this is, I'm loving this. I actually, we were joking earlier that we wouldn't go 3 or 4 hours. We may go a little bit longer because I'm absolutely loving this. If you've had some success too, that if it doesn't come with a dose of humility, that when you begin to walk into every room and every environment and think you've already figured it out, you already know, this stunts growth as well, because you're, what you're saying is it blunts you taking in new data and new information.
Correct, correct, you get it, you totally get it. You are denying yourself better data, more data to inform the decisions that happen. So don't do that. Don't do that to yourself, right?
All right, give us the exercise. We've been building up. Give us
more. Okay. So this is, there's, I'm going to give you a longer one just to describe the steps, and then we'll do like one that you can do anytime, all the time.
Okay.
So this is like a basic mindfulness practice. And I call it, again, tied to what we're talking about in the book and attention, the find your flashlight practice.
Great.
Because oftentimes it's not that we can't focus. It's that we don't know where we're focusing at any moment.
That's true.
So the instruction would be, and I guide people to kind of ramp up to about 12 minutes a day that our data suggests is beneficial to do this. But to start out, like, do 30 seconds of this. Commit to that for a few weeks and see how that goes. So the practice is essentially find a quiet, comfortable spot and take this time seriously, even if it's 30 seconds or a minute. Sit in an upright, alert posture, like a dignified, you know, if we do it now, it's just like upright, alert, dignified. And first step is just acknowledge, notice, shine the floodlight on your experience that you're breathing right now. Then what you're going to do is hone in on something that actually you notice is prominent in your experience of breathing. So do you notice anything that feels prominent, like the coolness of air maybe by your nose or maybe your chest?
It's actually the sound I'm making.
Okay,
nasally.
Great. Yes. Yeah, the sound, that's a great one too. That's where you're going to hold the point the flashlight. That's your attentional target for this short practice. So direct that flashlight right there. Keep it steady. You can close your eyes if you want to, whatever you choose, just to limit the sensory input. And if it hasn't happened yet, it surely will. Your mind will wander. And all you do in that moment is notice it. Ah, the mind has wandered away. Next step. Take that flashlight, redirect it back to that same attentional target. And repeat. So it's essentially focus, point that flashlight, notice, use the floodlight, redirect, get the juggler to do its job.
Oh my goodness. You know, can I ask about that?
Yeah, please.
When I first started this, there was like a judgment when I drift away.
Oh, no, it's a total win. It's a win moment.
It's actually a win because it gives us a chance to redirect the flashlight, right? This is so important because I used to, maybe you're further along than me, but in the beginning I was like, gosh, man, I'm gone this for like 24 seconds and I'm out. But you're actually saying that's actually a gift when we drift away because it allows us to build this flashlight, I'll call it a muscle, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we're coming back. That's really good.
But it's, now I hope it makes sense why I wanted to describe those three systems, because we hit all three in this.
It does.
And I think it's really important to not think of the wandering as a problem. The wandering, remember we started out talking about,
right,
50% of the time, it's the nature of the mind. I didn't say, Ed, if you happen to be one of those weird people whose mind wanders, like us normal people don't have that, you have mind wandering. I didn't say that. I said, when your mind wanders, because it's going to wander,
Very good.
Just bring it back. And not doing that with the added story, the added reactivity is so important.
You know, I was just thinking of the... I did a lot of work when I was younger, and I do now with kids. And I have so many parents almost judge their children for their, he can't stay focused in the classroom. He drifts away. Oh, and I'm just thinking right now, like, what a breakthrough this might be for some parents who are listening to this, to realize that that's actually, everyone is at 50%. Maybe your kid reveals it more than other kids do. Doesn't conceal it as well.
Right.
Maybe it manifests in talking out loud as opposed to scribbling on a sheet of paper. So it's more apparent. But this is something that even with, do you believe it, is there a particular age where you believe a child might be able to begin to build this, I'm calling it building a muscle because everybody can relate to that.
Yeah, no, practice. I think it is. It's practice, it's strengthening. So the first thing to say is that this brain system of attention is one of the slowest to develop. We don't fully develop this capacity till we're about 25.
Okay.
And one of the reasons is it relies on the frontal lobes, which are the slowest brain region to develop. So, you know, it does kind of drive me nuts sometimes, and I feel for parents when they're not happy that their children aren't paying attention, or their response is pay attention. It's not going to help at all. And in fact, understanding that that's the thing that is it's your child is not paying attention because they don't know that they should often, it's that they don't know where their attention is. Just like we are saying we don't know.
That's good.
So I think that the thing to really, and by the way, yes, absolutely, there's a huge enterprise of offering mindfulness training in a developmentally appropriate manner to children as young as preschool.
Really?
We can do these in very useful ways for children, but what you're having them cultivate is not just focus, 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 it's where are you right now? No, where are you? In a friendly, self-supportive way. And is that where you want to be right now? You know, when you talk to yourself in that manner of like, where am I right now? Is that where I want to be? All of a sudden, the world doesn't feel as dire. Like, oh, I'm over here. I think I want to be over there instead. I think that's what I should be doing right now is being over there. It's a different relationship. And if you, the younger that we can get people to start understanding that this is befriending your mind in a way that allows it to be used to your benefit.
That's fascinating to me.
Punitive to yourself.
Yeah, that I'm just thinking, I'm sitting here as a 50-year-old man. I've done different forms of meditation, mindfulness. I'm a relatively productive human being. And I'm confessing to the audience that oftentimes I'm going 24 seconds and I'm out of my attention my attention has changed rather. So the idea that we're concerned about our 8-year-old who might have the exact same, or does have the exact same scenario that I do. I'm just curious, has there been any data? Are kids even more than 50% where their attention moves? Or would you assume that because those frontal lobes aren't as developed? Or is it pretty much the same?
Okay, so here's the tricky part of assessing that with children, by the way. What does it take for you to even know if somebody's on task or off task, right? They have to have the awareness. It's something called meta-awareness.
Yep.
Awareness or attention to your attention. That is also a developmentally slow process. So we're getting a fuzzy read on them. I mean, we could take them into the lab and look directly at their performance on tasks. And they mind wander a lot. Their attention can be off often, off task often. But I don't think that's the thing we want to help cultivate, which is the counterintuitive thing. And I refer to it in the book as like a peak mind pivot. It's like we think that to focus better, we think we need to focus on, we need to train ourselves to focus. And I'm saying no. To focus better, train your mind to notice when you're not focused.
Gosh, very good.
So, you know, that's a totally different set of, you're exercising the floodlight and the juggler. The flashlight will do its thing. It knows how to do its thing. But really pay attention to the understanding of where your mind is moment by moment.
I did that during your TED Talk. You actually say something similar during your TED Talk.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, where am I now?
Yeah.
And then I'm back with you. And then where am I now? And then I came back with you.
And that's it. You know, 24 seconds, if you're truly going 24 seconds, we got to bring you to the lab because that's really good.
I made the number up. It's probably more like 2.4 seconds. I don't know.
I actually asked a colleague of mine who'd been practicing mindfulness for 30 years because I was getting, in the initial stages when I was just trying to understand what this thing is, I was like, I'm not going very long before my mind wanders. And will that be the thing that will extend as I practice more? That was my thinking. Like, that's a reasonable hypothesis. I might, if it's, 5 seconds now, maybe it'll be 10 and 15. Yeah. And each year I might get longer before it wandering. And I was very humbled by what he said. He said, 30 years of practice. He said, 7 seconds.
No kidding.
So at first I'm like, oh, great. What am I being bothering? Like, it's still going to be 7 seconds after 30 years. But what he said next really helped. He said, what has happened is that my mind now, instead of being completely lost in a fantasy or a doomsday scenario, and I love that it was like almost poetic. He's like, it's like I'm seeing the ripples you know, the ripples at the distance of the Placid Lake. Mm. And I was like, oh, he is really knows his mind. Mm-hmm. Like, he can tell a slight tug. He doesn't have to go full on into, you know, next vacation has been planned while you're trying to do 5 minutes of a mindfulness practice. Mm. That felt so much more like he knows his mind. He knows where it is that with that level of granularity.
Yeah.
And in some sense, this is the part that I think is also really interesting, especially as we talk about athletes and military service members and, you know, special operators, etc. It's this sense that you develop because you know your mind, a sense of, I'm going to use the term, mental toughness. Mm-hmm. It's like, I know this space. I know the lake. It may not always be placid. It's usually, for me, like a rough, stormy place.
Right.
But I can take anything. Like, my mind is here for it. And frankly, that's developing that same floodlight capacity. I am here. I'm present for it. I'm not going to be thrown off. I'm steady in the middle of whatever's going on.
Very good. You know, I think some of the most self-confident people I know are just more self-aware. And I think that's actually what you're describing.
Yeah,
there's an awareness of, there's an awareness of self. I'm loving this and I want to keep going. So I want to ask you about, you've described things in visual terminology a lot. And I'd like to think that I am a visual person also, although I don't know that there's such a thing. I'm wondering if part of that self-awareness is, are some people more predisposed to be kinesthetic or auditory or visual in their in the deductions they make, in the observations that they make? And is that something to be cognizant of about yourself when you're in a state of attention, that you are not just, I feel like I'm very visual, but maybe every single person is, or are there more auditory predisposed people, kinesthetic, visual?
I mean, the jury is out. Most people say now that, like, the notion of learning styles or specific modalities is not all that well supported. So I would say we don't know yet if that's actually the case. But frankly, the bulk of the brain as human beings compared to our little dogs that run around, so dominant with vision.
Visual.
But you brought up something that I want to kind of ping that.
Yeah.
Because that, what you described, is not what I'm talking about when I use the term meta-awareness. What you just described, very powerful thing to do, is something we call metacognition. So both of these are tied to self-awareness. Meta-awareness is a different thing. So metacognition is essentially knowing your tendencies, knowing your styles, knowing your decision-making capacities, your strengths, your weaknesses. I mean, everything you just described would be really great to know for your metacognitive style, for example.
Okay.
And yes, it can definitely, there could be differences, maybe not tactile or visual, but there are definitely differences in the way people operate metacognitively. So you may be a maximizer in your decision-making versus a satisfier. You know, there's these different orientations. But I'm not talking about that. Mm-hmm. What I'm talking about, when I talk about the floodlight, because remember, the floodlight system is really about the now. Mm-hmm. And meta-awareness is awareness of the moment-to-moment processes and contents within your mind. So it doesn't really matter from the meta-awareness point of view what your tendencies are. What is going on right now? Mm-hmm. Where is your mind right now? Mm-hmm. And I think that what's important now kind of orientation is so important in performance context.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter what you're doing. I'm like, what's going on now?
Is it bad to be dreaming in the future? Is it a bad or good? I don't even like that terminology, but
useful.
Yeah. Is it useful?
Okay, such better. A great question.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you asked me that, because I don't want it to seem like I'm saying, always be here right now.
Yeah.
No, that's not what I'm saying. In fact, this capacity to mentally time travel, to just like you did with your, what did you have for dinner last night, right? Mm-hmm. Is so useful for us. In fact, it may be the thing that defines us in our evolutionary advantage as human beings, right? We can displace ourselves in something called time travel, right? Mm-hmm. We can rewind the mind, we can fast forward the mind. You heard about me talking about that a little bit in the TED Talk. But it's not just about time traveling, it's also about mind traveling.
Okay, what's that mean?
Mind traveling is essentially putting yourself in the shoes and mind of somebody else.
Oh.
So both of those are really, really powerful things to do. Mm. When we talk about mindfulness, it's really, it's a solution to a vulnerability in our capacity to do both of those things. Mm. So the problem with time travel, though it's extremely useful for productively reflecting or planning, it becomes problematic under certain states. And I do think of the athletes, like my heart goes out to them oftentimes when I see mess ups, right? Like you did something, you totally messed up, and it happens.
Yep.
You glitched. If you can't stop rewinding the mind, you are no way going to be able to succeed in the next moment.
Mm.
So how do you get yourself to not rewind?
Very good.
Right? So, or...
Amishi, that's really good.
Yeah, and I think that the other part is, you may be in a, not the, necessarily the athletic setting, but in our, like even during COVID, like if you can't stop catastrophizing and worrying about the future...
You got it.
You're stuck. You're going to be probably have a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. So the reason we want to, and frankly, the same thing goes with mind traveling. If I'm constantly preoccupied about your view of me, mm-hmm. social anxiety is going to set in. Mm-hmm. So the reason mindfulness became such an important solution for me, going back to why we study in my lab, is because each of those things, ruminating about the past, catastrophizing about the others, overly caring about the viewpoints of an evaluation on yourself, hijack attention. It depletes attention.
Gosh, it's so good. So you're describing from a scientific standpoint all the things that people listening to this go, I'm like, I know this is true.
Yeah.
And I think this, the rewinding thing, man, it's just huge. So many people are in the rewind and just beating themselves up and repeating the same story over and over again. But the other thing that I've figured out is that oftentimes stress is time travel in the future.
Yep.
Meaning that it's not so much the speech you have to give or the sale you have to close or the putt you have to hit that is stressing you out. It's you projecting into the future the negative result of it. And then on top of that, what other people are going to think or say about you when you miss the putt, when you don't close the sale.
Exactly.
Is that not true?
Exactly. You describe both the mind travel and the time travel, right? Mm-hmm. Those are what I would really call the kryptonite scenarios. Like you're really, what all of that is doing is attention still being used, and you're draining it out. You're draining the fuel in spinning in those directions.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, you know, it's easy to say, well, don't do that. Get back to here and now. It's easy to say it. It's very hard to do because the tendencies are so strong. Mm-hmm. So you got to train for it, just like anything else that's hard to do.
You were going to give us one other, I think you were going to give us one other
so
one.
Let me give you the
another training.
It's
and
like
then, by
mini...
the way, let's get Peak Mind. Let's get the book so that we
you
also,
get the whole thing,
you
right.
get the whole thing. That's the whole idea. But one more of them would be, I'm driving in my car and I'm like, I want her to get me one more.
Well, the car is a perfect example. You didn't even know I was going to go there.
Okay.
This other practice is just called the stop practice. Practice.
Okay.
Literally S-T-O-P. And do it while you're driving.
Okay.
Do it while you're walking. Do it at any time you want. Stop is stop. Like whatever the progression of your life is in that moment, halt it. Take a breath. And that's this conscious breath, aware that you're doing it. Observe. O. Proceed. P. So it's just, it's a mini mindfulness practice. And I really think it's useful because you know where your flashlight is at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's right here, right now. I'm back.
Mm-hmm.
So use stop signs, use red lights to remind yourself to do that over and over again.
So good. I'm just thinking of something. When you asked me to do that, I actually did it with you. And I actually noticed a couple things in my visual space that have been here the entire time that I didn't see. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And
exactly.
We're going a little bit deeper probably than I should, but I there's a lot of things that your brain does on habit mode, correct? Like if I'm driving to work and I take the same off-ramp every single day, I think my brain is storing energy by doing something that's habitual. That's how I've always understood it anyways, that I'm taking that same off-ramp. Whether I'm right or wrong, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
The point that I want to make about that is that for me, I think for most people, being present is, even though, yes, there's a benefit to being in the future and rewinding, there's a benefit to being reflective and reminiscing in the past and gaining wisdom from it. But for most of us, that's not a struggle for most people. The struggle for most people is being present.
You got it.
And that's why this is so important, what you're teaching here. And for me, there's so many things in a given day that mindfulness practices make me just aware of being present that I'm curious as to, in practical application, how much time a day, I know there's no formula, but if you were just saying, hey, Ed, I'd recommend to you, it's 10 minutes a day, it's five different times a day, it's once a day, do it at the same time of the day, doesn't matter when you do it. What would your advice be on just building this practice?
As the habit aspect?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the last line of the title is invest 12 minutes a day.
Yeah,
so that gives you a sense of, and that number comes out of many studies that have suggested, you know, if you get to that amount, we tend to see benefits. And the more you do from that, the more you benefit. But if you don't quite get to that, it's almost like, is going for a walk in my neighborhood, walking my dog, going to build my physical fitness? Probably not. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be bad for you, but you're not going to get to that level.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the answer to the question of, the when would be, and you can get a deeper understanding of why I say 12 minutes if you read more about it, but just know that it comes from a lot
of... I did. I just want them to
a lot
know,
of
you know,
research. Right. No, I know. But right. I'm just saying, but your question regarding when to do it and the habit issue is the best time to do it is when you're going to do it.
Okay.
And that's kind of a, maybe a cop out, but literally the key to anything, and you'd probably say the same thing regarding physical excellence, right? The key is advantaging your capacity to create it and incorporate it into daily routine.
Yeah.
And so what I suggest for people, like I just said with when we were doing the short practice, if you think you can do 3 minutes, set the goal of a minute and a half and get the win of I did it. And yoke it to something that you already do. You know, my recommendation is something that you know you're going to do every day without exception, maybe right after you brush your teeth in the morning or maybe right before you have your cup of coffee, sometime that you know you're going to do it. And what I would suggest is just to play around with when that works for you is to try it at different times of the day. What many people say when we say try the morning, you know, just play around with the time of day is like people say things like, I love the taste of my coffee so much more. It's like I've actually tasted it.
Gosh, it's so true. I can't.
You know, so,
so true.
And why are you depriving yourself of that, right? Why are we rushing through? I mean, you're going to have the coffee anyway. Why not have a little bit more pleasure with that experience?
So, I have to just say, though, I was going to tell you off camera, but I'm so glad you said this because I forgot.
Yeah.
Which is that I just want to give everybody the gift of this, that, by the way, I'm nowhere near where you would be or other people. I don't think there's rankings either, by the way. It's not a judgment thing, but my sensory experiences, just in general, have been so dramatically increased by this practice. I people always say to me that there's this duality. Maybe one of the reasons they even like me is that maybe I'm sort of like a maybe a masculine dude, but I'm very emotional and very sensitive. I don't know that I've always been that way, but like I do find that I experience my emotions on a deeper level over the last decade or so, that my laughter is a little deeper and more joyous. The taste of food is a little bit more pleasurable. My acknowledgement and noticing beauty around me and the nuances and specificities of it, and not just the visual, but smells and wind hitting my face. I know this sounds ridiculous to some people. It's just richer because of this practice. Never mind being far more present and productive. And I think also for me, peak is such a word that I've used over and over. When I'm fully present, it appears to me that I've got better access to my vocabulary, better access to insights in reading somebody. Yeah. Do you, similar experience for you?
I mean, for sure. And it can be life-saving in many ways. And actually, you know, you described the plus side, and I think it's so great. It's like almost like, you mean I can just have more joy by being here more? Yeah, you can. But there's another part that I think is very important in the context of our action and our humanity. We're also more present to the suffering of other people. We're also more connected to other people. We also have more sense and respect for the humanity of others around us and for the environment. And I think that at this particular point, kind of in our human history,
consciousness,
we need to be more aware of what the heck is going on. We have very little time to like try to make things better for our planet, for example. And also with all the injustices happening, and you know, I was talking recently to somebody regarding this notion of burnout, and you know, so many people are feeling so burnt out. Can mindfulness help with burnout? And the answer is yes, mindfulness can help with burnout. But you know, actually in the context of a conference I was at with critical care nurses. Now, we know over COVID, that has been a group that has been very, very crunched, right? And the question was, can mindfulness help me with burnout? And I said, yes. And they said, but then the system, that the organization of the scheduling is the reason I feel burnt out. And I was like, yes, but there's no way you're going to demand change or even conceptualize how to create change
it.
If you don't have the capacity to see what's going on.
Yes.
So just, you know, use that as the next step to give back to those who may not have this capacity yet. It's like as the more present we are, the more we can enact change and empower other people to do the same.
It's so, you're so right. And I know you know you're right, but people have told me that the last 10 years or so, I'm just using practical experience for me, you're more patient than you used to be. That's sort of more like a symptom almost, that it is more what you have described, which is that I try to be present with people and see them and hear them and experience them more than fix them like I used to. And try to truly empathize and understand their experience and their reality. And I've always felt since I started this, like I wish more of, I don't care what political party you're part of, I wish more political people had that ability for empathy and understanding and just stopped and listened to people and didn't assess it all the time. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that I attribute some, if not most of that, to these practices. Because obviously I'm a performer, peak performer, expert person supposedly, but it's the other benefits of doing this that have enriched my life far more than the fact that I've made more money because I'm more present with people or these other things. I'm actually curious about this. What about memory? So is it that my memory can be improved because of this, because I was actually present in more moments, so I have better recall because my attention was where I was more often? Or is it that there's something happening in my brain where I'm developing the ability to recall and remember things better? Pretty good question, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, right? So because you could say, well, yeah, your memory's better. Well, maybe that's just because I was more present. Or is there actually something operating in my brain where is there new myelin forming in my brain? I don't know.
Well, first of all, this conversation is changing your brain. I mean, I don't just mean because it's some kind of massively transformative thing.
Which
every experience, every experience we have impacts the way our brain functions. So there's no divide between experience and brain changes. They're just happening concurrently, right?
Okay.
So yes, it is the case. So you're such a great intuition about neuroscience. It's awesome.
Thank you.
So yes, it is the case that the more we can get, the more attentive we are, the more granular, fine-grained the inputs are for our memory. Mm. In fact, attention is the gateway for memory. If you don't pay attention, there's no way that you're going to have the experience of encoding episodes in your life, gaining new information. Now, there are aspects of our memory that are outside the scope of something you need attention for after it's well learned. So for example, if I tell you, tell me across the board of a keyboard what the letters are, I mean, I can tell you, but if you give me a keyboard, I can type it. So that's an example of something we call procedural memory, which is you actually don't need your attention for that. But for episodes and knowledge, you need attention to input the information. You also need your attention to pull it out. So remember we were talking about the flashlight and your dinner meal? You have to have clarity of directing it to call up the right thing. So it is on both ends of that. And frankly, there's another thing to think about, which is that what did you call it, myelin? So yes, it ends up that long-term memory is a structural change within the brain. It actually becomes like fixed hard in terms of the neural connections that occur. That process is helped by having clarity of mind. And actually just kind of to really tie the loose ends of this conversation together, current models suggest maybe that's where all this mind wandering is actually happening. It may be a memory encoding process. The reason the brain pumps out thoughts isn't because it's just trying to mess with us. Mm-hmm. It's because that's the way episodic memory encoding happens. It's a replay button that just happens by default. And as it keeps replaying, things kind of harden into long-term memory.
Oh, this is so good. All right. First of all, I want everybody to get Peak Mind. I want them to get your book. The reason that I want them to get the book is because I think the application of what you're teaching is different for many different people. And I love things that have broad application. So I think if you're an athlete, you want to read this book. I think if you're someone who wants to find a little bit more bliss in your life and be more present, I think this is a book that you should have. And I think just having an overall understanding of one's self is why I think this work is so fascinating. And it's why my audience knows I love every interview that I do. I don't talk to people that I don't want to share with the world, but there are certain topics that just fascinate me because I like to understand why some of the things I teach work. I understand some of it. And you're helping me so much with that. Now, the last thing I want to ask you, by the way, I have like 83 more things that I want to ask you, but I want to ask you about two things to finish. It's one big question, but one, what does pressure do to our ability to pay attention? Does there an impact on it? Does it focus us, unfocus us? Does it depend on the person? How does pressure or perceived pressure impact attention?
Such a great question. Okay,
Thank you.
Yes, it is. It definitely has a relationship, but it has a lawful relationship. So pressure is not, it doesn't have a unitary effect on attention. So just think of a U and turn it upside down.
Okay.
That's essentially the shape of the curve. It's something called the Yerkes-Dodson function. And you've got, let's call it stress or pressure on the x-axis and performance on the y-axis.
Okay.
So pressure is low, performance is going to be pretty low.
Interesting.
There will be a point at which the pressure will continue to grow where you're going to be at your peak performance. And if you continue to push yourself beyond that, you're going to start ramping down.
There's a regression.
Yep. Okay. So here's the interesting thing about that. So there is a sweet spot. And we know what that is for us often. It's like, I'm going to be able to knock it out of the park in this moment. I have the right set of factors. The problem, and a lot of people, especially in the elite context, don't really understand that. And in particular, people like first responders, special operators, et cetera, that there are real consequences for when you're on this part of the curve, it can be life or death for many people. Even if it feels like it's the right amount of pressure for peak performance at one moment in time, if you maintain that same level of pressure over weeks, months, it's going to degrade you.
There's a regression. Okay.
So it will push you into the degradation part of it. So I think that's also really important to know. Often people are like, but I'm used to this kind of demand. You're not used to it for weeks on end.
Got it.
You know, and frankly, that's what a lot of the medical staff are saying. They're like, I could perform, you know, even if it was a full ward, I can kind of manage it. You didn't have to do it for 19 months.
Yeah.
And so we have to have... This is actually, I would love to be able to just say this almost as a public service announcement.
Sure.
We have, as a culture, a lot of attentional hubris. We think we can pay attention, and we cannot. But if I ask you, do you think that the guy behind you that's on his cell phone trying to drive is paying attention to the road? You'd be like, no way. Mm. Well, then why do you think you are when you're doing the same thing?
Very good.
Right? So it's like, really remember that and have attentional humility. Understand that. And also take care of your attention in that way. Like, you really check in. Like, even if I can focus at this level, am I still as focused as I was before?
Yeah.
That's the knowing it. That's not about, by the way, going back to, it's not metacognition anymore. It's meta-awareness. Yeah. What am I feeling right now?
I get that distinction now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you,
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. And I love the fact that, because I think some people try to avoid pressure or stress. What you're basically saying is there's an internal benefit to a certain degree over a certain duration that focuses us too much the other way. It's kind of like you walk out on stage. There's a certain level of butterfly or desire or awareness or anxiety that's actually sort of healthy, that you're in this peak state, so to speak, mind. And then there's a state where it becomes problematic, where it's too much. And I had a few experiences recently where I just went a long time under duress and stress. And I found myself in a couple of I'm filming a television show right now. There was just a day where I was just not, I use vocabulary for some reason because I communicate so much.
Yeah.
Just my struggle to pull, you know, adequate and articulate vocabulary out of myself was just really sputtering.
Yeah.
And it was just basically what you said. I was under that stress and duress for a duration that was longer than was beneficial to me. And that's when I guess you've got to be able to be aware and intentional about it. Last thing, by the way, I love this conversation. I really do not want it to end. I'm just trying to be respectful to you and my audience at some point, because they're used to a certain length show, because we really have not got into so many of the things that I want to. I'd love to have you back.
This
would be something
that
we would do again. But just as a basic thing to start. So you've gone pretty complicated. We've gone in and out of different topics, but someone just listening, they said, look, I'm going to get peak mind. And I would like to be more present. That's just to start. You've given me lots of practical things today. But if I ran into you in a coffee shop and it was Starbucks and we were sitting here having a cup of coffee and someone just said, where should I begin? Where should I begin? I'm at the end of the interview now, but where should I begin? Yeah. We're gonna leave everybody now.
Right.
And your final thing to them would be, this is where I would start, or this is what I would think about, or here's a strat, however you would answer what would you say to them?
That's a great thing. I mean, I think the one thing I'd want people to take away from this conversation and any insight to then promote taking action is pay attention to your attention. And I really mean that. Mm-hmm. I mean, watch yourself in that way. And do it, by the way, from a distance, which is gonna sound a little bit weird. Like, it's called formally decentering, but like as a bird's eye view.
Get above it.
Like, get above it and look at what's going on moment by moment. Oh, she's really feeling a lot of anxiety right now. Or, and even name yourself. Okay. Like, you know, Amishi actually is feeling really nervous right now, or Amishi feels a little bit sad. Part of the reason I'm saying to do that, and that is a way of paying attention to your attention, because you're like, oh, this is what's going on moment by moment. The reason to do that at a distance is because then you can't, remember what I said, you cannot have your attention in two places at once. Mm-hmm. By pulling yourself out, distancing the flashlight a little bit, you're gonna get more clarity of the whole scene. Mm. And then you can take action. And that's just sort of like, just try that out in your daily life. Yep. And then I would say really do read what I have to say and the prescription I offer, because I wrote this book really out of wanting to take it out of the lab. We found so many people had benefited, and I wanted it to be of benefit to a lot of people, because frankly, it's not just soldiers, athletes, and medical people that have stress in their lives. All of us do. Mm. And it's not just them that have periods of time where there's enduring challenge. We all will at some point, and we may not know where it comes. So when it comes, so it's like, train your attention like your life depends on it.
Amisha, you're awesome. And I was just thinking, you know, the work for my audience is what you've just said. And here's the one thing, everybody, in this day and age, when there's so much information available to you, and then there's what I would call sort of new or more breakthrough information like what you're sharing, your job is not just to digest the information. The work in our lives now is more not finding the information, because there's brilliance in this book. It's the application for you. How are you going to apply it? In what areas do you apply it? For me, the applications of Peak Mind are in almost every single area of my existence. When I say almost, just because I think it is every area of my existence. It's making me a better friend, a better interviewer, a better speaker on stage, a better businessman, I think a better father. And just, I'm happier as a result of it. And so I'm really happy you were here today and you came to my home to do this. So thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it. It was really good. All right, everybody, please make sure you get Peak Mind. This is the fastest growing show. All the data shows this on the planet. That's because so many of you share it. And it's getting all kinds of accolades and notoriety right now, as many of you know, simply because of all of you and the way that the show is spreading to people. I'm so grateful for it. I do this as a service to you because I believe we can make a difference in the world. And I think today's show proves that we can do that. So God bless you all. Max out. Take care.
This is the Ed Milet Show.